one agonizing moment, half of these people will be plunged into despair, and the other half into ecstasy. A frenzied rush, a fateful mark, and one deadly kick brings a surge of naked emotion. For 100 years, the fans have worshipped such high drama, millions of them, bonded together by the fortunes of their teams, though they may be as different as paupers, priests and poets. The passion for Australian football, sired last century on the playing fields of Melbourne, has bred a national obsession, making some men heroes, some villains, and some who are both.
Oh, it's one of the great spine-tingling intros to a documentary, isn't it? This year marks 25 years since the AFL celebrated its centenary year from when the Victorian Football League was first formed. And as part of the celebrations, the AFL commissioned a documentary titled 100 Years of Australian Football to be produced and released. And you know a documentary, I think, is successful when scenes are mimicked and lines are quoted from fans a quarter of a century later. David Barham was the executive producer of the documentary and is a well-respected figure in the media industry. And I'm pleased to say that he joins us on the line. Thanks for joining us, David, on the anniversary of the anniversary celebration, so to speak.
Thanks, Damien. Yeah, it seems like a while ago now.
I was going to say, can you believe it's been 25 years?
No, it's gone quick, that's for sure. It's gone really quick.
When you were asked by the AFL that you had the responsibility to produce this documentary, what was your first reaction and who actually asked you?
So Ross Oakley was running the league and Gary Fenton was running Channel 7 and they ran a bit of a tender process, I suppose, and there was a few of us said we wanted to do it. But in the end, I was very lucky because Gary and Ross said to me they wanted me to make it. So, I was really thrilled. I was running AFL. I sort of just started running my business, AFL Films, which is now AFL Media. So I'd probably been doing that for 5 years and had got to know them both a bit. And, I had about a year and a half to make it. So I was really thrilled when I got the chance to do it.
So you had a year and a half effectively to make it. Did that involve basically getting cameramen out on the ground? Because you've often, if you see the documentary, you had basically cameramen positioned at certain games. I reckon in the year or so prior, like in that intro, it was the 1994 preliminary final. It's a great shot of Gary Ablett taking that famous one-hander 2 seconds before the siren.
Yeah, amazing. I was there that day. Well, I'd sort of been filming stuff at the footy for the AFL for a while, so I sort of had a lot of material, but I remember being there that day when Gary took that mark because we'd filmed all day and we got nothing and we were standing in the middle of the ground and the guy said, Cameron said to me, where do you want to go? I said, Ablett had not had a kick all day and we went down to his end and we stood in the fourth pocket and sure enough, he took the mark to kick the goal after the siren against Mickey Martin, which I'll never forget. But so we had a lot of material and then we put a call. One of the things we did is we put a call out to everybody if they had material to send it in through the footy record, and some amazing things turned up after we did that.
Well, that's right, because historical footage prior to, I reckon, the mid-1980s is difficult to come by because TV networks used to tape over programs to save money and not retain any footage. Was that a big obstacle you faced?
Yeah, and that's why. So I started the AFL Library in about 1991 or 1992, and that was what I figured out was that they were taping over all the games, and I couldn't believe it. So I remember I went to Ross and I said, Ross, we need to start a library, and he said, okay, how much? I think they paid me $30,000 to build the library, and all I did was build a big room and fireproof it, and then we started keeping tapes of games and logging them and stuff like that. And it's funny because I remember going to Channel 7 when we were doing the 100 Years doco and saying to Channel 7, where's all your World of Sport? Yeah. And someone picked up a two-hour tape and said, here it is. and the whole of World of Sport was kept on 2 hours of tape. And there must have been hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours of World of Sport.
Well, that's 28 years worth. I think that show ran for 28 years and it was all condensed in 2 hours. Yeah. Quite amazing, isn't it?
Well, they had two. That's what they had, 2 hours of it. I remember going, this is amazing. And it was one of the reasons we built the library and built the archive for the AFL, because it just needed to keep everything because you didn't know what was going to be valuable in 30 or 40 years' time.
We're speaking with David Barham here on SEN, who produced the famous 100 Years of Australian Football documentary, 25 years ago that was. Is it true also that you had your own collection of footage? Were you someone who liked to archive various bits of footage for posterity?
No, but I had been producing the AFL's International Highlight Show, so I had a little bit of stuff. But no, I started collecting, really working on behalf of the AFL in probably early 90s, and that's when I started really looking for everything and finding everything, keeping everything, and it really just built into what is now AFL Media. But yeah, that was a really great experience, and I'm glad we did it now, because that's where all these memories live, in that library. You know, if you want to see the 1990 Collingwood Premiership, Tony Shaw lives in that library, that's where it is.
That's right. If you could produce a documentary again, would you have done anything differently now that you think back 25 years on?
No, not really. No, I don't think so. Things have changed a bit in terms of what you produce and how you produce it and how you deliver it. But no, we had some amazing experiences. There were some great moments in it. Like the John, I'll never forget, there's a few really funny things and amazing things happened, but the John Kennedy tapes were quite amazing. We sent this call out to say if anyone had any material that they thought would be good for this documentary, could they get in contact? And a guy rang me up and said, I did all this filming in the mid-70s with Ron Barassi and Tom Hafey and John Kennedy, and I filmed them all at three-quarter time, and I went, sure. And he said, no, I have. I've got it. It's in my shed down in Brighton. And I said to my guys working with me, Barn, I said, Barn, go down to this guy's house and see if he can come back. This guy says he's got all this material anyway. Barney went down there and there was 40 cans of film in this guy's shed, and they'd been sitting there for 20 years and they were rusted. And anyway, we took them to a film place and we sat there and we started spooling through all these reels of film. And it took a day and a half with a friend of mine, Greg Smith, and we kept going. We had 39th can, all of a sudden it flickered, and up popped John Kennedy saying, do something. And we were sitting there amazed, going, this is amazing. And then I saw John Kennedy over at the AFL, and I said, oh, John, I said, I found this material. Have you, saying, do something, Mick? And he said, no, it wouldn't be me, David. And I said, well, I think it is, John. And he goes, no, it wouldn't be me. He says, you know me, I wouldn't do that. And I said, well, you better come over to my office, have a look. So he came over and he sat there, and I put it on, and he sat there for 15 minutes with his head in his hands, and he didn't speak or say anything. I thought, because the tapes go about 30 minutes. And, and he just sat there, and eventually he said, yep, that is me. He said, I can't remember doing that. I don't believe I did that, but it was him. So we found that material, which was, really exciting at the time. That sort of stuff turns up. And, John must have forgotten he was doing it. It's also where Kevin Sheedy, where Tommy Hafey said, Kevin Sheedy, you're a back pocket plumber. And there's a bit of Ron Barassi there as well. So it was just great, but it's also great because you capture these guys in their moment, and that's what it is. And it's also, sometimes it's even better if it comes up 20 years later than it happening the day after, if you know what I mean.
Mm, that's right. It does give it probably a little more grace in a way, in the sense that you sit on it for a long period of time and it's a great revelation. We're speaking with David Barham. I'm in my mid-20s, and for my generation, it's easy to access archival footage. There's plenty of content on YouTube and the AFL website, etc. But 25 years ago, it was a treat to gain any form of nostalgia. Is that why you felt the documentary carried greater importance for posterity?
Yeah, I think so. And I think probably it was, I can't remember too many big things being done on the AFL before that. Like, there's been a lot of documentaries made since, but that was sort of probably the first big one where we tried to pull together. And I think it went about 2.5-3 hours or something. But it's funny because the first cut of it went about 4 hours. And we had to go and cut out about an hour of it, or an hour and a bit, because Channel 7 only wanted 2.5 hours, I think, for TV. So I remember them saying to me, no, you've got to cut an hour out. And I remember we took out, you'll notice Jimmy Stein story is not in there. And which is amazing now. And I've often thought about that Jimmy's story is not in there because he sort of didn't make the cut. But that was, we had so much material and so much good material that, it's a shame now it would have gone out on all sorts of different releases, and there would have been a long version and a short version and a digital version and a whatever. But at the time, it was just a 2.5-hour version for Channel 7. So we made some cuts and took some stuff out. But Jimmy was one of those things that didn't make the cut, which was sort of said how much great stuff was in there, I think.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because you worked alongside Neil Kearney, I think, in producing the documentary. Neil Kearney was the writer from memory.
Yeah, no, Neil deserves probably more of the credit than anyone for the documentary. Neil was the genius writer and constructed it, and so I suppose my role was... So we both worked on it, and we both sort of did a bit of everything, but I was really pulling it all together, making it happen, and Neil was the one who creatively was able to, you know, piece it together and write the beautiful lines that you heard before. You know, Neil's the... was a real creative genius behind. He did all of the interviews, pretty all the interviews probably, apart from the ones that we had in the archive. And so between us, we had all of the skills and all of the things we needed to do, but Neil was a massive part of it.
And I think you saw some interviews that Mike Williamson conducted back in the 80s, yeah. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah, we did. So there was, Mike Williamson did a whole heap that were in the AFL archive. It's funny, they weren't shot very well. So unfortunately, not a lot of them saw the light of day, but there were some with people who had passed away.
Like Graham
so we
Richmond.
Were able to use those. Yeah, there were some there that we used bits and pieces of, but yeah, but they were all still, they were there, and we reshot a lot, but where we couldn't, we would use, because we did this technique where we cut them out and put them on a background, and it was a bit, we shot them, a lot of them on green screen at the time, and we couldn't do that with mics, so we had to change what we did a bit. But yeah, there was a bit of that stuff there, and there's a lot of old stuff, you know, a lot of old stuff turned up. And yeah, and I was, and then we went and filmed all the things. I remember filming Sheedy and David Parkin playing chess.
Yes.
For the, and I'll never forget, because it was a funny story, because they'd been had that pretty strong rivalry between the two of them for all that through the early 90s and 93 grand final and whatever. And they weren't enemies or anything like that, but they weren't getting on my house on fire, that's for sure. So I asked them both to come and sit and have this game of chess and pretend they were making moves and doing things, and I wanted them to look meaningfully at each other, and that wasn't hard because they were looking pretty meaningfully at each other without me even asking. And but I'll never forget, we painted all of the black ones, the black pieces, with a red stripe, and we put the blue, painted the white ones blue and left the white dots, so they had them in their team colours. And I remember Sheedy looking down at the board, and along the way we'd lost one of the Essendon pawns before the thing, so he looked down at the board and he leaned over, and you could see he was one short, so he leaned over and picked up one of Parkin's pawns and he threw it on the ground. He said, "I'm not starting one short." And but neither of them knew how to play, and they moved all these pieces in all the wrong ways. And one of the funniest things at the end of it was, we didn't get many complaints about the doco, but I got about three letters from people who played chess saying that was a fake game of chess. They didn't know what they were doing.
That's absolutely brilliant. We're speaking with David Barham here on SEN, who produced the famous 100 Years of Australian Football documentary. The Peter Cribbins audio, where was that sourced from? Was that a voluntary distribution?
No, that was the Peter Crimmins stuff come out of the Kennedy speeches.
Right, okay.
That we found in the guy's shed. And, yeah, he talked. That was it was a three-quarter time speech in the 1975 grand final, I think it was. And he talked about not picking Peter Crimmins. He was really emotional about all that. And John was really emotional even when he heard it and when he saw it and replayed it to him. He was quite emotional about it. And John wasn't the emotional type, but you could see it affected him. So, that stuff is... and there was about 30 minutes of that.
Yeah, quite remarkable, isn't it? We're speaking with David Barham. The Dermot Brereton slow-motion footage, you speak of people mimicking certain bits of vision. People still mimic that to this day, with the inspirational music after he was crunched by Mark Yates at the start of the 89 grand final and he moved down to the four pocket, which set the tone in the early part of the documentary as well. Who was behind that move and, I guess, the music behind it as well?
We had a guy called Frank Strangio. He wrote all the music, so we made it, and then he wrote all the music to the pictures, which was fantastic, and that was a great experience. But that was another amazing thing. We went over to Channel 7, Gordon Bennett and Gary Fenton, so you come over and have a look at everything we've got. And so, and it was funny because TV stations do live hand to mouth, and you're sort of doing things on the run, and, you know, and what had happened is they'd shot all this material in that grand final, but a guy called John Bowring, who's a famous film cameraman, shot it all, and it was another tape was sitting on the shelf, and we pulled the tape off the shelf and put it on and gone, "What's this?" And no one had ever seen it before. And it was the Dermot slow-mo of him getting crunched and getting up and doing all that. And we just sat there going, "How amazing is this?" And so there were some really big things found at the time. And that was, I remember them finding that and going, this is amazing. You know, that and the Kennedy speeches, we were just gobsmacked at things that turned up.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I like the selection of Graham Dow, I think, as the narrator, who was an actor in the film Gallipoli. Yep. Was he the first choice? And how did you go about selecting the narrator as well?
No, Neil did that. Neil checked out a lot of voiceover guys and checked it out. Because he was writing it, he knew how he wanted it to sound. So Neil was the one who found Graham Dow. He was fantastic, and that was a really great choice. So Graham did that, and I know Frank wrote the music, which was fantastic, and a guy called Dean Shiel was the editor, and he spent, I reckon Dino spent probably 4 months, 5 months editing. It was a long job. It was a big, long edit that took forever. But, it was 18 months, I reckon, doing it. But it was great fun in the end.
Yeah, it's some memorable interviews throughout that documentary. I guess one topical one to focus on is Dr. Jeffrey Edelston, who recently passed away, and he formed part of that documentary in regards to the story of the private ownership of the Sydney Swans back in the mid-1980s. Is there a memorable interview when you look back for that specific documentary that you did face-to-face or that Neil conducted face-to-face that comes to mind for you?
I think the one that strikes me was Jack Dyer. And Neil loved Jack Dyer, and Neil's a closet Richmond supporter. He never comes out of the closet. He's a closet Richmond supporter, and he should be out by now. But he loved Jack Dyer, and he got Jack walking through the streets of Richmond with his old Gladstone bag, and then he sat in the stand, in the old Richmond stand, interviewed Jack, and that was a pretty pretty amazing interview. And it was just because Jack was such a legendary figure, and it was great to get him and be able to get him on camera and get it all done and get him to tell his stories and stuff. So I think that to me, when we had, I remember looking at that and going, this is fantastic. And I remember Neil did another great thing. He got a lot of the legends down to Punt Road and got them to look at training, and you pan through the crowd. And I think it was Bobby Skilton and Alex Jeselenko. And he just rounded up a whole of old legendary players, and they stood there watching training down at Punt Road, and that was just another amazing thing that he did along the way. So there's some great moments in it.
Absolutely. Up to 1996, as you mentioned before, David, there weren't too many documentaries in any capacity in the VFL/AFL. We've seen the popularity of the recent documentary on Amazon Prime and Amazon Plus. We know about the abundance of documentaries that arise from US sport as well, and even in the UK. Do you think we'll see more documentaries relating to the AFL, or is the financial market and demand different here in Australia? Because they can be costly exercises, as you know.
Well, actually, Neil and I are doing another one at the minute, actually. But we're actually nearly finished. I'm on the board of Essendon, and a year and a half ago, we started making the Essendon's 150 years old next year. So we started making the 150-year history of the Essendon Footy Club. And Neil interviewed 100 people. We've interviewed over 100 people over the last 18 months, 2 years. He's done them all. And it's about 4.5 hours worth of content. So it's a massive undertaking, but it's turning out really well. So that's something that we'll do at Essendon in the next 6 months for our 150th anniversary. For all my fans are going to love it, because it goes back through Coleman and Reynolds and the TV era of everything, and there's about 4 half-hour episodes on the CD era and stuff, so that's really good. So there's plenty of, there are a lot of docos being made now, behind the scenes, fly on the wall things, so I think there'll be plenty of AFL ones done. But it's interesting, the Amazon ones are great because that goes to a world audience, but there's no doubt probably AFL suffers and NRL suffers probably because we are a domestic sport rather than a worldwide sport, where you can go and do a documentary on you did a documentary on Ronaldo. What's your potential audience? It's in the hundreds of billions, you know. You go and do a documentary on, someone in the AFL, you're sort of a bit limited. So it does come down to scale and things like that. But, you know, it's still pretty popular in this country, and, we all love our footy. So I think there'll be plenty of docos made.
Were you always a history buff, David? And did you ever foresee yourself, as a youngster, producing and directing documentaries?
No, not really. But what I, what I, um, So what happened to me really was I started producing the AFL's International Highlights Show, and I love my footy, and I've always sort of been involved in Essendon, probably on and off all my life from mid-'80s all the way through with Sheeds and everything. What I realised very early was that we didn't have any, we weren't collecting and keeping our history, and it's really important. It's really, really important because even like what we're doing now at Essendon, you want people in 100 years to be able to listen to Kevin Sheedy, listen to James Hird, listen to Neil Danaher and understand who they are and what they did. And that is really important. And that's why the 100 Years of Footy documentary is so important because, you know, even in 100 years' time, through those John Kennedy speeches, you'll be able to get a feel for John Kennedy. It won't just be a legendary name. You know, we all think now, see, one of the interesting things was when we started making the 100 years, everybody said, oh, John Coleman could jump straight up. He could jump straight up. I don't know how many people told us. But it's no vision of John Coleman standing there and jumping straight up. So I remember thinking at the time, you know, I kept everything of Gary Ablett Sr. in that AFL library. Every time he played, everything's there. Everything you wanted to see of Gary Ablett Sr. is in that library. So when they make 200 years of Australian football, you will be able to see all these great players and characters in full flight. Whereas when we made the 100 years of football, we really only went back to the 80s or 70s maybe, were there any sort of great detail. So that's what's really sparked my enthusiasm for it and my interest in it, is that I realised how worthwhile it was when I started. And so I've always been, everywhere I've gone, I've really been, I've had a great desire to protect the history, because if you don't know where you've come from, it's hard to get anywhere else. And I think sporting organisations have got an obligation to do that. And so that's what sparked me.
Absolutely, and posterity is very, very important. Appreciate your time, obviously, David, tonight. Just a few more before I let you go. You speak about significant moments in the history of the game. This year actually marks 20 years, another anniversary, since another significant moment in the history of the game, and that's on the air with the changeover of the rights. That was announced in 2001 ahead of 2002, and TV rights has been in the discussion again with the A-League in recent weeks. There were subtle changes in regards to the alteration from Channel 7, which held the rights for 45 years. And you were a key figure in that, because weren't you the executive producer for Channel 7 in its last year, and then you moved over to Channel 10 in its first year executive producer?
I was executive producer of Talking Footy, and I was executive producer of Friday Night Footy in 2000. And then I did the grand final in 2000 for Channel 7, and then at the end of the 2001 season, Channel 10 took it over. So, I moved over as an executive producer for 10's footy in 2002, I think we started. But, it was big at the time, because to move, I think Channel 7 had done it for 39 years, I think it was. So it was a very big decision by the AFL, and then there was a lot of responsibility on Channel 10, because we had all the final series and first five grand finals. So I remember it being pressure-packed, I remember that.
Yeah, and the subtle changes that I mentioned, even having modern music to come out of the commercial breaks, that hadn't been really done before, because effectively Channel 7 used to have their theme, and that would be the only music you would hear in and out of breaks. Was that your brainchild as well, just to change up the coverage a little bit?
Everyone who comes in has their own set of ideas, so I had all my ideas on things that I thought we should do, and I copped a lot for and was good and bad was the 5-minute warning. I remember I changed the clock to count up, not count down, and I preferred footy where you didn't know when the siren was going to go, so I changed that. And everyone from Robert Walls was bagging me about that on my own team. So 50% of people loved it and 50% hated it, I think. But, everyone who comes in brings their own ideas, and that's a good thing. And also what happened then, which was great for footy, was Channel 10 had Saturday afternoon, Saturday night, and all the finals and grand finals, and Channel 9 had Friday nights and Sunday afternoon. So I remember Coscott Owen was working at Channel 9, and we were competing all the time, like in a really friendly rivalry. It wasn't nasty or anything like that, but he'd try something, I'd try something, he'd try something, I'd try something. So the game, I think, progressed a lot in those 5 years. And then the next 5 years, it was 10 versus 7. And again, we competed really hard with them in terms of commentators and the way we did things. And the game actually progresses a lot when you get change. So, you know, like, I had behind ground, there wasn't a lot of behind goal cameras till late 2000s or late 90s. Mm. People wouldn't remember now, but the game was pretty much shot from the side.
Yeah.
It was only in the late 90s and early 2000s when we said start shoot the game up and down the ground, which is now such a part of the game. So, yeah, and cameras in goalposts, things like that, that happened because there was change of broadcaster.
Just last two questions before I let you go. Just ahead to the future, do you think we've currently reached a tipping point for the amount TV networks will pay for the rights to televised sport?
It's hard to know because it changes all the time, but I think there'll still always be really good money, but I think it'll be shown in different places. So the anti-siphoning laws in Australia give the free-to-airs a really good chance of keeping major sport, but I think that'll be reviewed even more stringently in the next few years. And you've got all these different streaming people coming in now wanting to do things. It's like the 10 deal with the soccer, you know. A lot of that's is on Paramount Plus. So you're probably still going to have good money for sporting rights, but what's going to be incumbent upon sporting bodies is to make sure that most people can see it. And that's going to be the major. There's a couple of major things you've got to do. I think as a sporting body, you've got to make sure you are getting your product to as many people as possible. It's not just about money. So you have to make sure that, you're giving everybody the best possible chance to see your product in the best possible way. So, but it is changing, you know. Smart TVs, we're all sitting at home now, and, you know, looking at apps, and I watch all my NFL on an app. You know, there's lots of different ways to see things now. So I think it'll always be popular because it's still the best live drama sport is by a long way.
Yeah, that's right. And it is important to bring it to the masses via free-to-air in many ways in Australia, because you don't want it to be a situation similar to England, for instance, where a lot of sport is behind a paywall, effectively. And I guess that is a nice segue into my last question. Do you think it is conceivable to think that maybe in 10 years' time, the rights to televised sports such as footy and cricket will move away from TV networks and be held exclusively by streaming platforms?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. But there will always be... You'll always still have... Look, TV's going to change some. It's changed so much in the last 5 years. Who would have thought that we're all home watching Netflix and not watching a free-to-air TV program? So what do our TVs look like in 5 years? Maybe we've all got these smart TVs where, you know, there is no such difference. There's no difference between a free-to-air... There's no difference between free-to-air and Netflix. Maybe they're the same thing, and you've just got a controller in your house, and you click on your box, and you decide what you're going to watch. Now, if that's the case, you know, that just changes the whole TV rights landscape, because there is no such thing as free-to-air. And if there's no anti-siphoning rules, then that's maybe where we'll end up. So it's and this is where the great conundrum comes for sports, is how much money do you need to pay your players, run your sport, do all that? And how much do you need your free-to-air exposure or your exposure on TV? And that's the great challenge.
Particularly for Australian sports, because as you said before, they don't have the same reach as the globalised sports such as the NBA or the EPL. Hey, David, really appreciate your time. Thanks for going down memory lane in terms of revisiting the 100 years of Australian football documentary. It was one of my favourites as a child, and it is for many, many people of my generation as well, as a great historical viewpoint in regards to the game's history. All the best for the future, and thanks again for your time.
No worries.